org and freedcproject.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington. Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features War in Sudan 2 years on. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Muiza Muntali. The music in the background is Jabana by Nori and his Dopa Band. April 15th marks 2 years since war broke out in Sudan between the Sudanese armed forces led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, led by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti. Recent figures indicate over 12 million people have been displaced internally and externally as refugees abroad, and over 20 million people, about half the population, face acute food insecurity. Yesterday, I had a conversation on the situation in Sudan with Sarah Sidon in Cairo. Sarah Sidon is a member of the Sudan Solidarity Collective. The conversation dissects internal and external players, the role of multinational corporations, the role of the resistance committees, the humanitarian crisis, the role of the emergency response rooms in addressing the needs of the people, the solidarity efforts with Sudanese from abroad, and more. Here is the conversation. Sarah Sidon, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for taking the time out of your busy, hectic schedule. And also, I know it's a bit under the weather, so really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. This is 2 years on of the war in Sudan. If you could give us a little bit of background context of that situation currently, as to refresh our memories, filling in the gaps.
Absolutely. Yes, no problem. So April 15th, 2025, today, marks 2 years since the outbreak of the war in Sudan. On April 15th, 2023, the two warring factions in Sudan, namely the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, started battling each other in Khartoum. The battle started in Khartoum. There was conflict between both of them for quite a time, although they were allies for a bit. I think in order to talk about the war in Sudan, it's important to frame it within what happened in Sudan in 2018 and 2019, which were the revolutions that overthrew the dictator Omar al-Bashir, who had been in power since 1989. The uprising started in 2018. Unlike other uprisings in Sudan, it actually started outside of the capital, outside of Khartoum. It started in Atbara, in the city of Atbara, with protests against the rising costs of living and rising costs of bread due to, at the time, it was austerity measures by the IMF. These protests spread to the capital, and it culminated in 2019 April as well, with the stepping down of former President al-Bashir, who was then put on house arrest. The current war can be seen in the lens of the counter-revolution movement that started right after that uprising had begun. During that time, in 2019, there was constant demands of making the government become a civilian government after 30 plus years of military rule. The transitional government that came into power after 2019 was a joint government between the Sudanese armed forces or the military and civilian leaders. What happened in October 2021 was a joint coup between the current warring factions. So both the RSF and the Sudanese armed forces had actually together undergone made a coup in Sudan in October of 2021 against the civilian-led government. And between 2021 and 2023, a lot of conflict arose between those two parties. The RSF historically has been a militia that was formed by al-Bashir and the NCP government that was in power in order to quell uprisings in Darfur in the mid-2000s, the Darfur region of Sudan. Subsequently, in the early 2010s, the RSF, or the Rapid Support Forces, formerly loosely known as the Janjaweed at the time, started gaining more power and more capital in Sudan. By the mid-2010s and until 2019, until the time of the revolution, the RSF militia had control over a lot of the gold mines in Sudan, and it has become basically a parallel power to the official military, which is the Sudanese Armed Forces. When you do have a militia that is equal, almost equal in power to the army, there are two options. They had worked together for many years, including the time of the revolution in 2019, and in order to counteract the revolution. But again, like I said, by 2023, when the war broke out, these two factions have become enemies, and to the misfortune of the Sudanese people, the war broke out against the war involved both these factions, but as a result, many of the Sudanese civilians have become victims to this war. The war is currently the largest humanitarian crisis in the world, displacing millions. Over 11 million Sudanese people have been displaced, whether internally displaced people or ones to neighboring countries like Egypt, Chad, Libya, and Ethiopia. So within those 2 years, there have been advances and losses of cities, major cities, including Khartoum, was under RSF control for a long time. Only recently, about 2 months ago or so, or 3 months ago, major parts of the capital, Khartoum, have gone back into control of the Sudanese armed forces, as well as major cities like Medini in Al Jazeera state. It had previously been run over by a run or controlled by RSF for a while, but the Sudanese armed forces were able to regain control of that. In areas like the west of Sudan, in Darfur, the only remaining city that is still under Sudanese armed forces control is El Fasher, and currently it has been under siege for a long time. About 2 days ago, there was a horrific attack in the Zemzem camp, and it's right on the outskirts of the city of El Fasher in Darfur. It's an IDP camp, so an internally displaced people camp. People have been living in that IDP camp for over 20 years. Unfortunately, the RSF had laid siege to it and just a few days ago had attacked civilians, aid workers, and others in that camp. So this is just a brief history of the war that had unfolded in Sudan. It is important to note that this is, I think, one of the largest and most widespread scale of violence that Sudan has seen in over 100 years. This kind of widespread violence across geographical areas in Sudan has only been seen in maybe the British colonial rule and the anti-colonial movements. Although Sudan has had a history of, the longest civil war in Africa, and but they have been always geographically in certain areas. But right now, with this current outbreak of these two warring factions, almost all of Sudan has been involved in some form of violence of another, with a few exceptions of pockets of safety where the war hasn't reached. So I'm part of an organization called Sudan Solidarity Collective. We are based in Toronto, and the one thing we are combating, or our goal is, to reach to fill in the gaps of humanitarian aid and to support movements like the emergency response rooms, which are neighborhood committees all across Sudan that have formed to combat famine, which is a major food insecurity has become a major issue in Sudan. And to give assistance to people for medical aid, any form of evacuation that is needed from areas that are unsafe. So, in addition to supporting the ERRs or the emergency response rooms, we're also supporting small local organizations or initiatives like the Farmers Alliance, with a campaign to help farmers that are displaced or that are cut off from supplies be able to plant food in their backyard and support their small households and families. We also support the Tea Vendors Alliance, which is a unionized alliance that has existed before the war, as well as the Farmers Alliance. There's a long history of those. They support local women who are tea vendors and their families in order their livelihood has been disrupted from the war. So we are helping support these small humanitarian initiatives across Sudan.
And again, that is Sarah Sidon. She is with the Sudanese Solidarity Network. And we're looking at Sudan t 2 years on of the war in Sudan. And she gave us a very good background there of the complexity, the nuances of the conflict. And I wanted to unpack some of the things that you talked about to expand on the discussion, especially the part about the hijacking of the transition process by the military in October 2021. And I wanted to find out what happened to the people who led the uprising, who led the revolution in 2018, 2019. Where are they now in the current scenario because of the conflict? I can imagine it not being safe for them.
Yes, absolutely. So many of the young people that had led or were part of the sit-ins, there was a massive sit-in. I think at the height of it was over 1 million people in the capital city of Khartoum, in front of the military headquarters, demanding a transition to a civilian, led government. In June 30th of 2019, there was a counter-revolution attack against those people. Many had died in that incursion to the citizen, and it was actually carried out by both of the warring parties right now, so the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese Armed Forces. During the period of transition, many of the people that participated in the revolution were frustrated by the process of the transition. It was taking longer than expected. There was a lot of issues with both the civilian branch of the government and the military one. After the coup that happened in 2021, there was a lot of repression of these revolutionary voices, of course. And again, even further, after the war had broken out in 2023. Because of the nature of this war, where it's two sort of military entities that are fighting each other, whether it's the Sudanese armed forces, which is in many ways a little less violent towards civilians, the civilians had to, many had to choose a side, whether to side with the RSF or to side with the Sudanese armed forces, whether it's to be for their safety or geographical location or ethnic affiliations. But at the end of the day, the majority of the civilians were caught in the crossfire, let's say. Yeah. So many civilians who have really no business of about the with this war or with either warring factions were basically trapped or forced to flee from their homes. And like I said, it is the largest displacement crisis in the world, with I think the latest figure has been 11 million displaced. Some displaced internally, so moving into safer areas of Sudan, and many displaced into countries bordering Sudan. For example, my own family is currently in Egypt, as well as many Sudanese families who have crossed the border after the conflict. Many have also crossed the border into Chad. These are the two largest movements outside of Sudan for displaced people. And again, others have gone into Libya or Ethiopia. Many are in Uganda and Kenya as well, as well as others that have had more means to flee to places like the Gulf States or Europe and North America. So, unfortunately, many of those who had participated in the revolution and have had been voices of change have now been forced into survival mode due to this war, along with the rest of the population, or have been, suppressed due to the nature of the conflict that has broken out.
And the suppression, as I think, to be clear, the suppression of those voices started before the conflict between the two generals, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Because there's always been
Yes.
the tension of the military, just like the neighboring country, Egypt. The military has always played this humongous role, and of course Sudan. Most of its independence has had military rule, to a certain extent, and so that's been the big tension within the political class, right?
Yes, for the majority of Sudan's history, with the exception of a few years here and there post revolution and post independence, Sudan has been under military rule, whether it's during Jafar and Nimeiri in the 70s or prior to that, 70s until the 80s or prior to that, Aboud, both of which have been ousted by a revolution very similar to what happened to al-Bashir in 2019. He was also ousted. He was also a military ruler who was ousted by a revolution. However, the history of suppressing revolutionary voices has been present in Sudan again for decades. There is a long history of that happening in Sudan, and there is a long history of the military rule controlling much of the finances of Sudan's in GDP. The army for a long time had controlled about 70% of Sudan's economy. But I think the thing that is different now within the past 5 or 6 years is the presence of another militia that has become almost or has become very powerful and also very economically powerful, in which for many years it controlled a large portion or all of the gold trade in Sudan, as well as the livestock trade in Sudan, both of which have not actually stopped during the war. So gold has continued to be smuggled outside of Sudan, as well as livestock has been continued to be traded outside from Sudan to elsewhere, although this would a majority of this will not appear on official files, but in a way that has kept the war ongoing, as well as, of course, support from outside forces and other nations to prolong this war.
Yeah, and as you're saying, I wanted to also unpack that that connection of the outside forces. On one hand, you have the rapid support forces supported by certain countries, of course, and then you have also the Sudanese armed forces supported by some other countries. If you could unpack this as well, because it also has put these countries not who tended to be on the same side in the past. We're talking about the countries on the other side of the Gulf, and now all of a sudden they're picking sides because of the resources in Sudan.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that has made this particular war in Sudan different from many of the other civil wars in Sudan is the support to either side by third countries or countries outside of Sudan. And in a way, because of this proxy war, it has prolonged the period in which the conflict and the violence has been ongoing for over 2 years now, or 2 years exactly. The Rapid Support Forces has well, Sudan has officially accused the United Arab Emirates of supporting the Rapid Support Rapid Support Forces in the ICJ. Just a few days ago, the hearing had started. And on the other side, the Sudan Armed Forces has received support from countries like Egypt, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. And again, like you had mentioned, many of these countries that have chosen a side to support in Sudan in other instances are, getting along just fine. But when it comes to Sudan, as with other conflicts, it boils down to an issue of resources and which country or entity would like to have their hands on these resources. There's also been involvement of Russia. There has always been the presence of Russian paramilitary into that, even before the conflict. But during the war in Sudan in 2024, there was a particular incident in which both Ukrainian forces and Russian forces were seen to battle each other in Khartoum. So it has become a sort of a third battlefield for outside countries or outside conflicts to play out in Sudan. The other thing, involvement of non-Sudanese actors in this war actually predates the war itself. The rapid support forces have been paid. There's a contract called the Khartoum Process, and it's a contract between the European Union and the United Kingdom with many actors in the African continent in order to quell the refugee movement from Africa into the Mediterranean and Europe. So essentially, the European Union and the UK had paid large sums of money to the rapid support forces, and this is all official. There is a website and dedicated to this process and how that system worked from the year of 2014 up until late 2019. This was ongoing. So the Rapid Support Forces militia was able to beef up or build up its capability as a militia and as a military through European Union funding and UK funding for a long time. As I said, many actors have been involved in this war, and that is what makes it different from any other conflict that had happened in Sudan.
And it's interesting you mentioned the EU and other forces in Europe, because as we speak today, there was a one-day talk, peace talk, that was co-hosted by the African Union in London. And I guess the other parties were the British government and other European governments. How do you see those talks being any type of positive influence on the ending of the war, particularly because neither side of the warring faction was at the table?
So, this has been a particularly interesting talk or series of talks to follow, because neither side, like you have said, have been invited to participate in this. And both have issued statements saying that they feel excluded in this conversation, and that's happening in London regarding the future of Sudan. However, it does shed light on which particular countries and cities will decide the future of Sudan, and it's not likely to be the Sudanese people. The biggest clue is for this to not involve any of the civilian society of Sudan. And this was part of the issue with the revolution in 2019. The conversations that the international community was having were with military, were either with the Sudanese military and or with the rapid support forces, but very little was paid attention to the civilian actors and the civil groups in Sudan. So I had heard somebody speak before and say the final destiny of what happens in Sudan will be decided not in Khartoum or Port Sudan or any other major city in Sudan. It will be decided in cities like London, Abu Dhabi, Cairo, Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, Washington, D.C., etc. So I think it really does shed light on ultimately whatever change or however this happens. It is not only the decision of the Sudanese people that will come into play.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration, on Friday, April 25th, from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Everam and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
You're listening to a conversation with Sarah Sedon. She's a member of the Sudan Solidarity Collective. The conversation is contextualizing the war in Sudan 2 years on. The music in the background is Blue Nile by Alice Coltrane, and we play that commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
Doesn't that also make it a fait accompli that history will repeat itself, that we'll have continuous warring in Sudan, and the innocent civilians will be still suffering because we're not getting their voices on the table?
Yes, absolutely. This is a concern that civilians have had. However, they are, for the majority of Sudan's population right now, they are in survival mode. Many people have not been able to have the luxury of thinking about what is a day two scenario and what scenario will unfold once this war comes to an end one way or another. We know that civil wars eventually end with a deal or a negotiation. Very rarely does it end with one side or the other having complete victory. As we can see here in Sudan, it's one side will advance to certain areas of Sudan while another side will take over another geographical area. And because of how particularly large Sudan is in a country in Africa, these scenarios can play out for many years, in which there will be conflict in one region and peace in one region, and then the cycle could repeat itself. So I think many civilians have hopes in this conflict ending. Many are very frustrated because of the extreme violence they have seen, particularly from the rapid support forces towards the civilians. Although both sides have been accused of war crimes, the more heinous ones have come from one side of the battling sides, for sure. I think many Sudanese people are just hoping that there is an end to this, but there is, like you said, the possibility that this cycle might repeat itself due to involvement of outside forces and due to the non-resolution of what started this conflict in this first place.
And as you said, there's been so many heinous crimes committed against civilians, particularly women who have been really hit hard by this war. But as you said, of course, there's the human rights reports from various organizations, as well as international multilateral organizations, have indicated the rapid support forces being, having had more of the abuses. Both sides have had abuses, of course, but it seems like there's a huge number from the rapid support forces, particularly using rape as a weapon against women. And this has played itself out really harshly in the Darfur region, which once again has been hit hard. 20 years ago, people had heard about what's happening in Darfur region. And I think to kind of bring it back to understanding what the rapid support forces, their role in the Darfur region all these years, they didn't just come out of thin air. They were there as well 20 years ago, right?
Yes, absolutely. So the rapid support forces have evolved from the initial Darfur crisis in the mid-2000s, and they were formerly known as the Janjaweed, or the new iteration of the Janjaweed have become more formalized into the rapid support forces. But they were militias that were, at the time, they were used by the Sudanese ruling party, which is the National Congress Party, or NCP, to suppress any uprising in the Darfur region. And they have been trained, or the methodology that they've used in the mid-2000s was a particular strain of extreme violence, a scorched earth method, the use of sexual violence against women, all of which we have seen to come about again in 2023 when this war broke out. Now, the use of sexual violence as a weapon of war has a long history in Darfur, but it has also come about in regions that have not seen it before. So we have seen reports of sexual violence against women in places like states of like Al Jazeera, when the rapid support forces were stationed there and were able to take over many of the large cities there. But there has been widespread of that use in Darfur, unfortunately, again today. And unfortunately, with the same sort of methodology and brutality that has been used 20 years ago. So although this particular war has spread out to most regions of Sudan, the violence that Darfur has seen, and especially in these past few weeks, in these past few days, with the attack on the Zemzem IDP camp, has been particularly heinous and particularly violent. And the interesting thing about the Zemzem IDP camp is that it is a camp that has been present there for over 20 years. So the people that have lived in this camp, other than people that have fled the most recent violence over the past 2 years, but many of the elderly there will remember the violence that had happened 20 years ago with the precursor for the rapid support forces, the Janjaweed forces, back in the Darfur crisis in the mid-2000s. So this is kind of a repeat of the cycle for them. While places like Al Jazeera or Sinnar state may have not seen that level of violence in the mid-2000s, Darfur, unfortunately, has seen this before. And this has been kind of a repeat of the nightmare for them.
Again, that's Sarah Sidon. She is with the Sudanese Solidarity Network. And She's speaking to us directly from Cairo, and we're looking at Sudan 2 years on of the war. Now, in the final part of our conversation, I wanted also to expand a bit more as we're talking about the war's impact on, the heavy impact on the civilian population. But at the same time, you're also seeing the heroic efforts by the organizations that you had mentioned before and at the beginning of our conversation, which the Sudanese Solidarity Network is trying to support in filling in the gap for aid, supporting like the emergency response rooms, and also the Farmers Alliance and Tea Alliance. If you can expand a bit more on the specific work of the, particularly, we can start with the emergency response rooms so that people have a clear understanding of what they're doing in this very challenging times.
Sure thing. So the emergency response rooms have evolved from the neighborhood committees that have formed during the revolution. So during the revolution in 2018 and 2019, neighborhood committees came together to protect the neighborhoods and to form formal defenses against attacks by the government at the time and counter-revolutionary forces, whether it's by the police, armed forces, or the rapid support forces. So these neighborhood committees had formed and had formalized structures in which each neighborhood would have, and they formed connections between each other. So the neighborhood committees in Khartoum, the capital, would form connections with neighborhood committees in Kassala in the east or in Darfur in the west. They, after the revolution, they took on a more humanitarian role in which they provided aid after the outbreak of the war. In particular, they were assisting evacuations. People were evacuating from one neighborhood to another, and they were helping them access transport and support for them to do that. They were helping set up field hospitals or field clinics to treat people. And lastly, as the war progressed on, they set up community kitchens. Due to the food insecurity that was happening in sieged places and the famine that was starting to break or starting to happen in various areas of Sudan. So these are the three things they've been working on: evacuating people that were internally displaced, supporting medical care, and lastly, the largest bit has been now going to the community kitchens that are feeding entire neighborhoods. When the war broke out in April of 2023, many international organizations evacuated a lot of their staff. So a lot of international organizations that were working in Sudan became sort of just skeleton a staff that was working and operating. A few have stayed for the entire duration of the war, and namely Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, the Norwegian Refugee Council. So many organizations had left Sudan, and initiatives like the emergency response rooms were there to fill in the gap. And because these are grassroots organizations, they do depend on other Sudanese people, whether from outside of Sudan or from places that are safer in Sudan, to support them, to help save and feed and sort of give medical supply to the different neighborhoods and cities and towns in Sudan. So it is Sudanese led, and it is Sudanese funded. They have received a few funding from international organizations, but after the recent Trump, the recent decisions and shifts in policies, they actually a lot of their funding was cut. So they are depending on many of the fundraising initiatives, ours and others, like the Sudan Solidarity Collective, to fundraise for them. And you can directly support the emergency response rooms. But it is a Sudanese led and Sudanese, mostly Sudanese funded humanitarian relief efforts. So they are grassroots organizations that are trying to combat the overwhelming, the massive humanitarian crisis that we have.
Thanks. And also you mentioned also the Farmers Alliance and also the Tea Vendors Alliance. If we could briefly talk about what they're doing right now and under the present circumstances in Sudan.
Yes. So the Farmers Alliance, which has a long history of in Sudan, has formed officially in the year 2000. So over 25 years of supporting farmers in Sudan, made a project after the disruption of farming in Sudan due to the war of a campaign called We Must Plant or We Must Farm. So it's a campaign to give farmers that are displaced or ones that are still in their home lands in the state of Al Jazeera, which sees a majority of the farming in Sudan, and also the state of Managil and the area of Managil, to give farmers a chance to grow their own crops to combat food insecurity. Because of the looming famine and the famine that is announced in some areas of Sudan, there has been a great crisis in food insecurity in Sudan. So this initiative is helping people grow their own food in their backyard, as well as the second phase of this campaign is to try to cultivate small plots of land using zero intervention farming, as in there is no fertilizers or modified seeds in order to grow large crops or large areas, but ones that could sustain life and sustain the people that are living in that area and provide for them. So this is one thing in particular that we have been supporting and funding for the past 5 or 6 months. And lastly, regarding the Tea Vendors Alliance,
Usually women who set up tea stalls on roadsides or in towns, cities. You can even see them all over the capital city. So this is an alliance to help them. Many of them, their work has been disrupted by the war because they live on a kind of a day-to-day income basis. We are helping support the Tea Vendors Alliance with what they need for continuation of their work, as well as to help their families that have been displaced or have also lost income due to the past 2 years of the war.
And finally, what are the role or what are the hidden hands, I should say, of multinational corporations in this conflict in the war in Sudan?
Multinational companies in Sudan has had a dark history, in particular when it comes to the mining field. in the mining of precious materials like gold. Sudan is one of the has the largest reserves of gold in Africa. It's certainly in the top 10. And as well as other precious material like uranium and others. So they have colluded with militias like the Rapid Support Forces and other non-state actors in order to preserve or to benefit from the resources that will be freely available to smuggle outside of Sudan within this the cover of this conflict and this war.
Sarah Sidon, thank you very much for being on our show, and we hope to have you on again to dissect the these challenges of Sudanese as they deal with the war.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, I'd like to thank everyone listening and to encourage them to check us out at Sudan Solidarity Collective. We are online on most platforms like X, Instagram, and others.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You just been listening to a conversation on the situation in Sudan with Sarah Sidon in Cairo. Sarah Sidon is a member of the Sudan Solidarity Collective. The conversation contextualized the two-year war in Sudan. It dissected the internal and external players, the role of multinational corporations, the role of resistance committees, the humanitarian crisis, the role of the emergency response rooms in addressing the needs of the people, the solidarity efforts with Sudanese from abroad, and more. The music in the background is Al Amal by Nori and his Dopa Band. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muizam Ntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shahanana Hussein Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East. And that's followed by the women's collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by the Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Clea Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Koza and Funa Ngonda. And our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And thank you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW, and particularly support the upcoming program that's the celebration of WPFW's 48 years. That's Still We Rise, and that's on April the 25th. For more information, visit WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Furaha by Nairobi Horns Project, commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
I'm Dennis Williams with the WPFW editorial. Kilmar Abrego Garcia, an apprentice sheet metal worker raising three children with his wife in Prince George's County, has been kidnapped by the United States government. On March 12th, Abrego Garcia was pulled over by ICE agents, accused of being a member of the Salvadoran gang MS-13, and then transported to a terrorist confinement center in his native El Salvador. In fact, Abrego Garcia had fled his homeland at 16 because of threats from local gangs, and a U.S. immigration judge in 2019 granted him protection from being deported because he would face persecution if he ever returned. The Justice Department admitted that his removal was an administrative error, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the government to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia, who has never been charged with a crime or found to have any gang affiliation. President Trump shrugged and said that it was up to El Salvador. Salvadoran dictator Nayib Bukele, appearing in the Oval Office, scoffed that the idea of releasing him was, quote, preposterous, while Trump and top advisors smiled approvingly. This is an appalling violation of law and of justice that must not be allowed to stand. If Kilmar Abrego Garcia can be disappeared in this way, none of us is safe. This is Dennis Williams with a WPFW editorial.
Reparations Valley, Saturday, May 17th, a festival of unity in celebration of the ongoing quest for reparations, as well as the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. Speakers include Michael Eric Dyson, Robin Ruth Simmons, O'Malley Yeshitela, Ajua Ayatoro, with virtual remarks from Marilana Karenga, actress Erica Alexander, and Ben Chavis. Performances include the rapper Razzcaz, along with DC's own Ayanna Gregory, Afi Soul, Lucy Murphy, Nana Malaya and the Malcolm X dancers and drummers, Free Benjamin, Randy Payton, and Laini Mataka. May 17th, Landsberg Park, 1098 Delaware Avenue Southwest, 11 a.m.
How we gonna make reparations mine? Educate, educate, organize. How we gonna make reparations mine? Educate, educate, organize.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Iverum and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
Greetings, family. This Wednesday, April 16th, friends, neighbors, and comrades from all across the Washington area will assemble at Metropolitan AME Church for a D.C. Emancipation Day speak out to strategize, organize, and mobilize from 5:30 until 9 p.m. The event, Standing Together to Fight the Power, presented by the Metropolitan Washington Council, AFL-CIO, and the Federal Unionist Network, together with Harriet's Wildest Dreams, Free DC, The Washington Informer, and WPFW, will center how the community can protect DC home rule, save federal jobs and services, and support the city's most vulnerable neighborhoods. Metropolitan AME Church is located at 1518 M Street Northwest in DC.